I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Doug Frost is both Master Sommelier and Master of Wine, one of only four people in the world to hold those dual titles. Frost added winemaker to his resume when he ventured out to Oregon and bought a vineyard of his own. Today, a special conversation we had during a lunch at Kansas City's Room 39, where Doug Frost led a group of up-to-date fans in a wine tasting. We learned why some grapes are harvested at night, what it means when a wine tastes oaky, and how professional wine tasters get through judging scores of wine in competition. Chef Ted Habiger joined us too to tell us about the considerations he includes when it comes to pairing wines and food. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's a good day whenever Doug Frost is in the house, and in the house on this day means Room 39, the Ted Habiger-owned restaurant on 39th Street in Kansas City. We're gathered here today with a group of KCUR and Doug Frost fans who are going to learn about and taste good wines at the feet of the master. Doug is a genuine master. He's one of only four people on the planet who's both a master sommelier and master of wine. Doug, it's, like I said, it's always a good day when you're here. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah. Great to be back.
And our thanks to Room 39 for hosting us here today. You know, you've got some good news. You've added vineyard owner to your long resume, and this vineyard is in Oregon, as in the state of. Tell us about it.
Yes, indeed. I'm not sure that's good news.
Why not?
It's a bit of a challenge. Farming is not my strong suit, and so I'm not sure exactly why I've decided to become a gentleman farmer, but there you go.
Why did you decide?
Well, I have a business partner, and we discussed this and decided that starting a winery in Washington, on the Washington side of Walla Walla, the Walla Walla AVA or American Viticultural Area, we started a winery there, or at least have begun making wine there. And then the vineyard that I found is just across the state line in Oregon, also in Walla Walla, but on the Oregon side. And so we planted that in May. And now we're just dealing with farming.
So why did you want to get a vineyard so far from home? Why not back in Kansas or Missouri? You've extolled the virtues of wine out here in Kansas and Missouri for so many years. So why Oregon?
I am so busted right now, aren't I?
Yes, you are.
I've been saying all these nice things.
Yes.
And it's like, when offered the opportunity to vote with my money, I went, okay, see you later.
See you later.
No, the truth is that the grapes that grow and prosper out here are a different set of grapes than grow and prosper in along the West Coast and in other areas. And my particular interest was in trying to grow an interesting Syrah. And I don't think Syrah does that well around here. So given the opportunity to try to make an interesting Bordeaux blend and an interesting Syrah-based wine, I decided to go to a spot that I thought was really, you know, kind of a sweet spot.
Hmm. Is it as romantic as we tend to think it would be owning your own vineyard?
Well, I never thought it would be romantic at all. It's been as stressful as I had assumed, only the stress came quicker than I had assumed.
Really?
I mean, there's already, you know, issues with pests and it's the, you know, it's the logistics of the whole thing. It's the you know, reality of being in a particular space and being hostage to the vagaries of the weather and the climate have been indeed as much of a challenge as I'd expected and probably worse.
That's not how people think about vineyards and owning one, though. They think about it as an incredibly wonderful experience where you're out on the veranda in the evening sipping wine, looking over your acreage, and you're telling me it's something very different.
It's not like in the car commercials, okay?
Yeah.
You know, where somebody hops out of their brand new whatever and trips through the vineyard. It's more a matter of walking through the vineyard and going, oh my God, what's going on over here? That looks like it has some virus. Oh my God, something's wrong with the irrigation line over here. We got to deal with that. You know, it's just farming. And anybody who's ever ever done farming is at this point laughing at me because city kid learns the reality of it all.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, as is true to fashion here, you've brought with us any number of bottles of good things that we're going to be sampling here and tasting on this edition of Up to Date. This first bottle you brought is a true champagne because it comes from the Champagne region of France, right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's certainly that we have long ago decided to use the word champagne for any sparkling wine that comes from anywhere. The Champenois, perhaps as a side note, spend about 90%+ of their marketing budget in the United States suing people who use the word champagne to describe a sparkling wine that is not from the place of champagne. For instance, they sued some lady who was making a chocolate champagne. You know, she put champagne inside the chocolate, and this is not to be done. Which I think is kind of silly. But I honestly do think that sparkling wine in the region of Champagne in France, with the incredible chalk subsoils that they have, soils and subsoils, makes for a different style of wine. And this has, to me, a kind of a yeasty, biscuity, doughy, bready sort of character. And that toastiness, with time, will develop into things that are a bit more complex. Sometimes it can become a little weird and mushroomy and cheesy, and sometimes it just gets more and more like toasted biscuits and can become quite exotic and wonderful. And that's what I look for in champagne.
Now, we've had this lesson before, this idea of brut champagne, which means dry. You've talked about that before. That may be the only thing I remember from our past conversations about brut champagne, but describe it to us and tell us more about it.
Well, indeed, the word brut or brut would indicate that it's a sort of standard blend. And that's to say that it's going to have typically Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, and Chardonnay blended together, different vintages blended together. So Brut non-vintage is what we think of when we think of most champagnes. And then the other factor would be that it probably has about 1% residual sugar in it or so, because that's sort of the standard. That standard is not certainly not determined by any particular reality. It is just historical. That historically speaking, people drank champagnes with a touch of sweetness to them, and the standard style, as we've known begun to call it, the Brut, was really the British style, the Gout Anglais, as we called it. The Gout Américain, the American flavor, was usually a lot sweeter, probably 2%, 3%, sometimes as much as 5% residual sugar in there. So when it came time, really, prior to Prohibition in World War II, for Americans to try a new style of champagne, that style was called extra dry. And yet, extra dry is sweeter than Brut, because it was still sweeter than the Gout Anglais, or the English, or the British flavor. I mean, it could have been worse. The Gurus, the Russian flavor, was like 15% residual sugar, not your mama's Cristal. It was very, very different.
Well, we have a table full of professional samplers here in front of us here at Room 39, and maybe it's a good time for you all to take a sip. Instead of just talking about this, you can take a sip and tell us what you think. And when you're ready to give us your technical analysis of what this champagne tastes like, just signal to Danny and we'll get your reaction here to it.
And it's okay to make faces.
Yeah. Well, what do you think?
I don't normally like champagne, but I like this.
What do you like
this
about it?
It's not as dry.
Yeah.
So it doesn't burn when it goes down your throat.
Yeah. Largo, what did you think?
I actually, this is my favorite libation of any kind to have. So this has a bubbly effervescence that I really like. But I do like the dryness of it, and I think it's more full bodied in its flavor because of that.
Wonderful.
A bubbly effervescence. Can anybody else here at the table top that magnificent kind of description? We're using the big words here today. What did you think of it?
Well, I don't know about bubbly effervescence, but it goes straight to a happy place in my brain right away.
Doug, what is the happy place in the brain? Can you describe what part of the biology we're talking about?
Well,
there in the brain?
You know, the effect of alcohol on the brain and the body is pretty complex. So, no, it would take us a while to talk about that. But there's no question that a little shot of alcohol, used to be the way people started their day, whether it was with beer or with spirit or with wine. Just a little bit of, you know, something to warm you up and get you going. We live in a different world than that today. We don't normally have champagne first thing in the morning, and I suppose there are people who regret that.
You know, why is it that people say that sparkling wine is the most technical wine in the world? Why is that?
Well, it is that you make a wine, and then typically if you're making wine according to the champagne method, and most of the high-end bubbly that you ever see is going to be made in the same fashion. You make a wine, you stick it in the bottle, you put some more yeast in there and a little bit of sugar so the yeast have something to feed on, and then you put a Coca-Cola crown cap on top of that and wait. The yeast will go ahead and convert that sugar into more alcohol and the bubbles that are going to show up in there, and then you wait. And you might shake the bottle up every now and then. You try to get the yeast cells to add their flavor and their complexity. But you'd better know how much sugar and yeast you're putting in there, or there's going to be too many bubbles, and the thing will blow up.
Mm-hmm. As we go along here, if you guys have questions for Master of Wine Doug Frost, we're open to your questions beyond just my questions as well. You know, I'm told that the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition just a few days ago did a cover story on regional wines, and two locals made the list, Doug. Holyfield Vineyard and Winery's 2018 Dry Vignole for $15 made the list. We did a broadcast out there last year and enjoyed several of their wines. A good pick by the Wall Street Journal, Doug?
Yeah, absolutely. I was really, really grateful that Letty Teague, the writer who wrote, who created that piece, covered those two wines. She came here and acted as one of the judges for a wine competition that I run that we just actually concluded our annual version of that called the Jefferson Cup. And Letty came out, acted as a judge. It was really quite fun because she said she was just going to pop in, taste a couple wines, and then walk around and take pictures. But she fell in love with the whole thing and fell in love with all the wines that we had there because we have wines from about 38 of the 50 states, and a lot of them are unusual varieties, and she hadn't had Holyfield before. She certainly hadn't had Vox Vineyards before, so that was really fun to see, and to see that she still remembers that couple years later.
I was going to say, in Terra Vox up in Platte County was picked for its Seigneur, also from 2018. I hadn't heard of them before. What do you know about them?
Well, that's a very cool project. It's primarily focused upon grapes that we call in the industry the Munson varieties. It's a crazy story, but there was a guy named Thomas Volney Munson going back to the late 19th century who experimented with growing grapes that would prosper in this part of the country. He ended up in Texas, but that's certainly he was part of that group of people, primarily Missourians, but also Texans, who started creating grapevines that would prosper in Europe after what's called the phylloxera crisis. Basically, there's a microscopic bug that comes from the United States that ended up in France in the 1860s, and by the year 1900 or so, it virtually destroyed every vineyard in Europe. Well, you know, you're welcome, Europe. Glad we could help. But we also have the solution, which is to say, if the bug coexists with the grapevines that grow here, then the solution was to plant those same American grapevines in Europe. Well, we didn't like the wine that they made, so we grafted, or people grafted, European vines onto those American roots. What Munson did was, aside from helping ship those rootstocks and those grapevines to Europe, he also tried to propagate and create new grapevines that would also have, if you will, the best traits of European vines and American vines. And he made hundreds of these, and then they were forgotten. They were forgotten for about 60 or 70 years, and now there's a handful of people in the United States, literally, you know, fewer than five or so, growing these same grape varieties, and amongst them is Terra Vox, or Vox Vineyards, just north of town. So to me, it's a really exciting project.
Wow. How do you know all this stuff? It's just amazing you know all this stuff.
I just keep drinking and reading.
That's what you do. But the fact we've got two local wines making this list has got to say something about the heartland here and its ability to produce great wine.
Oh, absolutely. I'm a big fan of Holyfield, as a lot of people know. It's always a funny story because going back 20-some years ago or so, I was on KCUR, and I was talking about Missouri wines, and someone mm-hmm. called up and said, you never talk about Kansas wines. And I said, well, you know, and this is going back 20-plus years. I said, well, you know, I haven't really found any yet that I want to talk about today. There are numerous. But the woman on the phone said, how about if I send you some? And I was like, oh, my evil plan worked. And it was Michelle of Holyfield who sent me some wines, and I have really since believed that the wines are as good as anything made in the country.
Well, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're coming to you from Room 39, and we're joined this morning by Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, and a table full of KCUR supporters who are savoring his selections here with us. We have another wine here you want to talk about. This California vineyard and winery had this line about its 2016 Sauvignon Blanc. To achieve this crisp minerality and bright acidity in the wine, we harvest at night for optimal fruit freshness that ensures our signature style Sauvignon Blanc. Really? I mean, why at night?
Yeah, night harvest is a fairly common practice. It can get during harvest time, particularly in California, but there's a lot of other places in the world like Australia that can suffer from really rapidly increasing temperatures in the morning time. So by 10 o'clock, it could be 95 degrees, and that's not really good for the grape. It'll start to dehydrate grapes. It may in fact induce fermentation. You're just not going to get the grapes in optimal condition. So you try not to pick big bins. I mean, basically, one of the reasons that people talk about huge scale wineries being less quality oriented than small scale wineries is often as simple as when you see a large scale winery, just everybody dumping their grape cluster bins into a massive truck, and the weight of the grape starts to crush the berries, and the juice is now available, and the bees get to it, and the yeast gets to it, and it starts early fermentation. So a winery that's very focused upon quality, whether large or small, will often have just very small handheld bins. They stack on top of each other rather than crushing each other. And so night harvest is just one of those, another one of those techniques that people might employ to make sure that the grapes are basically not crushed yet.
And I bet that adds an entirely new ambiance to the idea of harvesting grapes, going out at night to do it. That'd be kind of fun.
You got to have headlamps, let's put it that way.
Do you?
And actually, the other big advantage is you're not dealing with yellow jackets, because yellow jackets can be pretty intense. I actually was involved in harvest in both Washington and Oregon this year, and one particular pick that I was not, these were not my grapes, I was helping a friend, I was covered in earwigs by the time the sorting was done, and that was gross. Yeah, gross. I'm going to go with gross.
I bet.
Yeah.
But we have this Maxwell Sauvignon Blanc here. Describe it to us, Doug. How would you characterize it? And then I want to get reactions from our table here as well.
Well, Sauvignon Blanc is a grape that shows up in a lot of different guises. The New Zealand style of Sauvignon Blanc has become dominant, I think, and it's very herbal and very crisp and sort of grapefruity, and that's wonderful. But I think actually California is doing a great job with Sauvignon Blanc in various different styles. They have more of a fresh fruity style typically, but this one is a bit different. This one is kind of broader and shows some oak elements to it. It seems spicy. It seems almost like cooked lemon peels and things like that. It's quite a bit different. It's a very, I think, a very distinctive style. So I thought it would be fun to show.
How about some reactions from the table here? Who wants to comment on Doug's description of it as being broader? Is it broader?
Well, the lemon really strikes me.
Oh, really?
It's very lemony to me, but it's also very smooth. So that's kind of where that oak comes in, rather than just a really sharp, acidic feel. So
I just love listening to people as they try to describe wine. It's such an interesting exercise in use of the English language. Former Mayor Wassmer is going to offer her 2 cents here.
I'm picking up pear and apricot, mm-hmm. and definitely different than the grassy New Zealand.
Yeah, I think you're quite right.
Pear and apricot, she pointed to. Yeah. You know, over the years, Doug, you've referred to yourself as a flavor craver. What do you mean by flavor craver?
Well, I suppose it's just a justification for my unwillingness to stick to any particular grape or any particular style of wine. I'm always trying to find new flavors, new aromas, because I think that's what's interesting. I mean, there's tens of thousands, perhaps even hundreds of thousands of different grapes out there somewhere. And so I'm keenly interested in discovering what I can about them. So I'm always looking for, you know, a flavor I don't know yet.
Hey, as you get older, do you get pickier?
Wow, I think you do, but I think it depends upon who the person is. There's research that suggests that as people get older, particularly in their 30s, they're probably more open to new flavors, but that starts to shut down. Certainly there's research that suggests that men, as we get into our 70s, are become less sensitive to aroma and flavor. Women, as they get into their 80s, are. And that might, underscore one's tendency to stick with what one knows. But I find that, like a lot of wine people, I become bored with a certain flavor after a while. And so I find that very frustrating, because the wine industry in general loves to crow on about how this is the new thing or that's the new thing, much like people will say, well, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you know, I'm really tired of that. Well, maybe the rest of the world isn't, you know, so don't badmouth it. Chardonnay in particular, which is what I'm keen to pour here in a second. There's a whole school in the wine and restaurant industry called ABC, Anything But Chardonnay. And I find that so insulting. I mean, it's really rude, because just because you're bored with Chardonnay doesn't mean everybody else should be bored with Chardonnay. I'm not bored with Chardonnay.
Well, as Doug just said, Chardonnay is on tap, and we return from a break. More wines with Doug Frost from Room 39 here. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Sign up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, for behind-the-scenes moments and my thoughts about guests and show topics. You don't want to miss it. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. It's quick and easy, kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, the 2020 election year is just under a month away, so it's a good time to analyze the presidential primary process. We'll do that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. We're visiting today with Doug Frost, Master of Wine, Master Sommelier, one of four people on the planet with those twin distinctions. We're coming to you from Room 39 here on 39th Street in Kansas City, owned by Ted Haberger, a longtime supporter of KCUR. Doug, we're talking Chardonnay here and about a winery just outside of Healdsburg, California. That's an area that's been involved in the Kincade Fire. Can vineyards come back from something as catastrophic as a major fire like that?
Well, the fires that we've seen over the last several years have been devastating to everybody in wine country and other, you know, other areas of California and the greater, you know, western United States.
The Sonoma Valley's gotten hammered, hasn't it?
Yeah, Sonoma's had some real problems. One of the interesting elements here is that vineyards act as a perfect firebreak. They're one of the few things that don't burn as those fires go along. So the vineyards actually have helped rescue.
Why don't they burn?
There's irrigation lines there. There's not a lot of dry material available there. It's not like the eucalyptus trees that the eucalyptus oil will warm up and the tree will literally explode and the oil flies all over the place and sets other things on fire. Nothing of the sort happens in vineyards. So they've actually, you know, there's a lot of people who over the last several years have lost their homes, have lost their wineries, and the vineyards are still intact.
Wow. All right, how much did Chardonnay help in putting California wineries on the international map here?
That's a really good question. I think it's a big factor. I think the style of California Chardonnay, even though it's veered back and forth, in general is viewed as one that's bigger and buttery and creamy and spicy and sort of, you know, really easy to grab a hold of. I think that style has been one of the reasons that California became famous. There's no question in my mind about that at all. Having said that, what we're having is Jordan, and Jordan tends to be a more elegant style, more refined style. The gentleman who ran Jordan has been the winemaker there since its inception until just the last year or two. Rob Davis, who's been there for 30 years or so, he kept to that style, which was a bit unusual as California Chardonnay goes, and yet it still has a certain buttery, creamy spiciness to it. I mean, it still is from where it comes from.
You know, you always hear this term oaky to describe Chardonnay because it's aged in oaky barrels. Did that term get overdone somehow? You know, is it too much? Everyone says oaky.
Yeah, it's kind of actually my favorite story about that is that I once did a wine list for a restaurant that's now closed in Westport, and the owner wanted me to put descriptors on the wine list, which I hate to do, but I did it because he said to. And then it went to the printer to proof it, and I had said this is a buttery Chardonnay with an oaky finish, but of course there's no such word as oaky, so the printer changed it to okay. So, it was a buttery Chardonnay with an okay finish. It's got an okay nose, but it's not a great nose. And it was one of those, that I should learn from that. Oak doesn't smell like anything per se. This oak table really doesn't have a smell per se. But when you put wine or any alcohol beverage inside an oak barrel or any other wooden container for that matter, it will leach characteristics out of there. Those tend to be bitter, astringent, spicy elements. And so that... when we said oaky, what we meant was spicy. When we said oaky, what we meant was buttery. And really, butteriness has almost nothing to do with oak. It has to do with what's called a secondary fermentation or conversion. It's getting all scientific on you, but it's called malolactic fermentation. And you convert green apple, i.e. malic flavors, into lactic acid, something like lactose, even something like butter.
So to be a master of wine, you got to be a chemist.
You have to be able to pretend be a chemist.
Like you're a chemist.
That's
okay.
It. Before we play one on TV, that's it.
Before we go any further, I want to invite our chef and host today of Room 39 to join us. Please welcome Ted Haberger to our table here, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks, Steve.
Ted, when you send a dish out to a table, do you ever worry that the diner is going to pick a wine that's going to somehow overpower that dish and sort of render all your hard labor moot?
Absolutely, but we do kind of choose our wines to be wines that will go with our food. So we tend not to focus on big, huge kind of beauty pageant wines. I often refer to the big California Cabernets that are 17% alcohol. They don't really go great with food, and so we tend to focus more on Pinot Noirs, things with more acid.
So what comes first for you, picking the food or picking the wine?
That's a very interesting question because Doug and I have done a few of these projects before where I think Doug knows me well enough that I tend to wait until the last minute to say what kind of food I've got. So sometimes Doug will already have the wine picked out, and I will then come up with a menu, and then we'll kind of piece it together from there. But, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I can create food based on what the wine is or what we think what the wine is going to taste like, But other times it's great to plan the food out and then go down in the cellar and pick the wine to match it.
Can you give our guests a little bit of a hint as to what they're going to be tasting later today after we do our show? We've had a whole wild sampling of wines here today, so I have no idea where you're going with this.
Right. So it's actually kind of a fun week for us. This is going to be our 15th anniversary coming up. And so
congratulations.
We opened in 2004.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
that's an achievement in the restaurant business.
It really is. I worked at Cafe Allegro, which was right down the street, and they were open for 17 years. And I can't believe that I'm going to be right nipping at their heels coming up. So,
well, what's the trick of staying open for that many years, Ted? I mean, as we've talked before about, a lot of restaurant goers want variety. They want something new. They want something fresh. And there's a premium on that in your world. How do you combat that?
Quality and hospitality. Those are the two things that we constantly worry about. We want people to come into the restaurant and feel like they're recognized as humans. Here, we love you. Come in. Let's feed you. Let's give you a good experience. And back that up with really quality food that is based on relationships that we have with farmers and the creativity that can occur when you're just cooking in the moment.
Yeah. Ted, always good to have you. Thanks for taking
Thank
some
you.
Time.
You bet.
Before we move away from our Chardonnay, does anyone want to offer us their 2 cents on what they just tasted with the Chardonnay? Yeah, Patty.
You've brought me back to Chardonnay. This is fabulous.
Oh, it's lovely.
It's really, really good. No, thank you.
Patty, what makes it fabulous in your view?
I'm so used to, when you talk about the oaky factor or whatever, that overwhelms certain wines like that. So I really appreciated what you had to say, and this is just smooth.
See, you don't get this kind of quality of wine out in Philadelphia. That's why it's good to have you here for a few days. This is this is a whole different experience for you out here in the Heartland, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Anybody else want to comment? Yeah. Mayor Wassmer's going to queue up some more, another review here of the Chardonnay we just tasted.
Well, my friends who know me will be shocked to hear me say this, because generally Chardonnay is my least favorite varietal, but this is delicious. It's very light and crisp and just very, very easy to drink. It doesn't have the, what I would say, the traditional characteristics of the really thick, gooey, buttery, heavy Chardonnay. It's
and
it's
as
perfect.
You're saying that, Barbara's nodding her head right next to you, Mayor. Light, and you like that description, yeah.
Well, let me just ask a question about the oakiness. You know, I'm a single malt Scotch fan, and which are always aged in oak barrels. So can you comment on the different effect that oak has on the wine as opposed to the Scotch?
It's a fascinating subject, and we could talk about it, you know, forever, frankly. But certainly when you're putting something in a barrel at, let's say, 15% alcohol at the most, usually closer to 13.5% alcohol in the example of wine, that's a very different solvent, if you will, than when you stick whiskey inside a barrel on the island of Islay or up in Scotland and you're dealing with single malt Scotch, and now you have something that may be 60% or sometimes 65% alcohol. So for one thing, you're really leaching different things out as a result of that. The barrels themselves that people typically use in single malt whiskey, they'll split between old, used American oak barrels that have been used to make bourbon and whiskey and things like that. So they're actually charred on the inside, and then they'll typically use at least some portion of what are called sherry barrels. Sherry being the wine that's made in Spain. It's typically not burnt on the inside like whiskey barrels would be, but toasted on the inside, and it may have some sweet sherry or sweeter wine that's been inside that barrel during that time.
John?
Steve, you mentioned that you needed to be a chemist to understand some of this. Is there actually a science of the combination of amino acids within a wine? And going beyond that, is there a, when you pair wines with food, is chemistry involved there, amino acids and sugars and
That question's asked by a physician. You can tell that by the question. Yes,
and I'd have to be honest to say, yes, but we don't understand most of that. Most of it is preferential. Very little of that interplay between food and wine is universal. For instance, the most egregious example that one can talk about when one is talking about combining food and wine is a heavy umami characteristic, which is a glutamate, a glutamic acid, let's say in oysters, with a tannic red wine. Now, that's universally seen to be a terrible combination, but and this is extremely unscientific on my end, but over the years I've tried that with people just to see what happens, and I would say about a quarter of the population has no issue with it whatsoever. For most of us, we say, it creates a metallic flavor in our mouths. And we can look at why glutamic acid and tannin might create that, but we still can't really fully explain why it works for some people and it doesn't work for others. And that's the most egregious example I can come up with. The rest of it is all preferential. So it comes down to, you know, there's a mechanical or an electronic tongue that's being used right now that people talk about to break down wines into aromas and flavors. And we can break it way, way down. But at the end of the day, there's still no better sensor than the human body for saying it tastes like this, it feels like this, it smells like this. So the answer is yes, but.
We're visiting with Doug Frost today at Room 39, tasting wine, going to have a great lunch afterwards. Tough show today, folks, but somebody's got to do it. Doug, tell us about your next wine here, Crianza. Let's go to Spain and talk wines there.
Sure. So the winery is called Tinto Pesquera. The producer is a guy named Alejandro Fernandez. And Crianza just refers to the fact that this is a wine that hasn't been in barrel any longer than a year or so, which is kind of a typical time for most red wines.
I would say we're going red for the first time today.
Yeah, the other thing that's really fun about this, I don't know if anybody can smell it, but if you want to smell the glass right now, the thing to look for would be maybe an aroma of coconut, maybe an aroma of dill. And if that doesn't work, think sawdust. Think going through a lumber yard. And the reason it smells like that is that the primary barrels that were used for this are American oak barrels. And American oak barrels can be produced in a way that's cheaper and or I should say less expensive. I don't mean qualitatively cheaper, but less expensive than European oak. You see, if I take American oak and I saw it across the grain, it won't leak. But if I take European oaks and I saw those across the grain to try to assemble a barrel, they'll actually leak. So to make European oak, you have to split everything on the grain, and to make American oak, you can saw across the grain. Therefore, you can smell a wine that's been in an American oak barrel. It'll smell a little like sawdust, which is crazy if you think about it. As sensory creatures, we can sit here and go, oh, yeah, I know how you made the barrels that you put this wine inside, and it's almost a universal experience. I mean, I'm not getting 100% recognition, as it were, at the table because it's not super obvious, but I think it's there. I mean, anybody else buying into this?
Yeah, you're getting it.
I'm getting nods of recognition.
Who wants to review the Tinto Pesquera for us here? Any show of hands who wants to render their judgment on what they just tasted here? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, my question is about the kind of oak. In other words, I know that there's a big difference between red oak and white oak
in terms of
its ability to conduct fluid.
Yeah, American oak is white oak, generally speaking. I mean, there's a few exceptions, but generally speaking, we use white oak. In Europe, there's a couple of different oaks that'll be used over there. They don't go by the name white oak, but yeah, they're all oaks. So chestnut, some other woods are used as well. Redwood used to be a big thing in California, but most of us have decided oak and occasionally chestnut are really the right woods for wine, and white oak is what we use here.
Anybody else wanting to review the Tinto Pesquera?
Well, I really do experience the toasted coconut in the smell. It's more prominent to me than the sawdust, but when I drink it, it really has the deep black fruit flavor. So, for not long aged wine, it really has some really deep, complex, beautiful flavor to it.
Doug, what are the growing conditions in Spain offer to the wine we're tasting here?
This particular wine is from a place called Ribera del Duero. Tempranillo is grape, and it's grown up at about 4,000 feet elevation, 3,500 to 4,000 feet elevation. And so I remember one particular July day, I was there just a couple of days after the 4th of July, and it was in the 90s, and they were freaking out because it was so hot. And I thought, where I come from, 90s is no big deal. Plus, the humidity was probably 10%, and where I come from, we do 90 plus 90% humidity, But that night, the low temperature was about 42.
Wow.
And that creates a different condition for the grapes to grow in than often in a lot of places in California or Australia or places like that. So, those conditions, I think, help the Tempranillo grape to succeed there. It's a grape that doesn't succeed in many other places.
Okay, let's move on to yet another wine here. It's back to France in Medoc for a 2012 wine that received enthusiastic reviews back in 2015. Has another 4 years made this wine any better, Doug? What's your sense?
It would. The extra time should make the wine a little softer. If you've ever heard of the idea of people decanting wine, typically we do it because as a wine gets older, as a red wine, I should say, gets older, it will start to produce what's called sediment. Throw stuff. It'll be stuff in the bottom of the bottle. And that's, it's not going to hurt you or anything, but it's kind of gritty and it's not something you want to drink, and it'll get stuck in your teeth, if you try to drink it. So that sediment is actually coloring matter and bitterness. Bitterness and the coloring matter will form larger molecules that eventually fall out of solution. And so a wine like this now having been aged for 7 years should be a little softer, a little less astringent, a little less bitter than it was when it was first released. released.
Okay, this is a wine that mixes, tell me if I'm wrong, several different grapes here. It's a blend, if you will. What are some of the reasons for making a blended wine, Doug?
The quick and easy answer is that the stupid farmer plants one crop, okay? You know, it's like, it's a bad idea. Ask the Irish in the mid-1800s if it's a good idea to plant one crop, one potato, one type, you know? It creates conditions under which as soon as there is a blight of some sort, such as the potato blight of the mid-19th century in Ireland, you're out of business. So traditionally, people have planted multiple grapes. Traditionally, in Bordeaux, you had Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Carmenere, Saint-Macaire, Sauvignon Blanc, Semillon, multiple grapes, because that way, no matter what the weather, you were able to ripen at least something. And what we discovered in as a result is, in the case of this Bordeaux, a real classic Bordeaux called Chateau Graissac, blending those different grapes together actually makes theoretically a more complex wine, too.
You know, this particular wine got 90-point ratings back in 2015. What gives a wine a rating that robust, that high, Doug?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, honestly,
you don't know.
Well, you know, it's all so personal, and the idea that some critic is going to taste this and say, "Well, that's 90 points." I don't wish to call any wine critics out because I try not to put points on wines because I think points are sort of pointless. It is really a personal thing. We all like different things because our bodies are actually responding to flavors in slightly different ways. And there are documented cases where wine writers have been given the same wine three times over a month and given it three different scores. And that, of course, then leads the press to say, oh, see, it's all nonsense. But the truth is, wine changes. And we change a little bit, too. Drinking this wine today in the morning is probably not as pleasing as it would be tonight in the middle of a meal, you know?
Oh, I've seen
at 7 o'clock in the evening when you're now relaxing and you're midway through your meal, this is probably a really cool wine. At, 11-something in the morning, I don't know, man. let's ask.
So when you're at a competition and you've got to sample literally dozens of wines a day, how do you keep track of the different ones that you've tasted? What's your note-taking system look like? How do you keep track of it all?
Well, I certainly have to take notes. Typically, the wine competition we just ran, each person tastes about 125 wines a day. And so you write everything down,
oh my
God.
You
take notes, and you spit. Professionals spit while they're tasting. And then watch every wine professional at the end of any wine competition. Where will you find us? At the bar, drinking beer, okay? It takes a lot of beer to judge wine. It really does.
You mean that literally?
I'm dead serious. It's the first thing you do. You're like, give me a beer. I need a beer. I really need a beer.
Okay, who wants to give us a little review of this latest wine we're tasting here from Medoc over in France? Largo?
I wanted to know if there's iron. I'm tasting iron.
There are a couple of different compounds that may provide that flavor of iron. One of them is a sugar-eating yeast, basically, called Brettanomyces. And there's probably a little bit of that. And that often gives a sort of blood character. But a lot of producers in this area think that it's actually the soil that gives that characteristic to these particular wines. I'd also argue it's probably used barrels that give kind of feral note. But nobody's really sure.
Did you like this wine, everybody? How did this one... Yeah, this one, I'm getting a lot of nodding of heads. You're so-so, John? So-so, Mayor?
I'm getting farm stench.
Yeah, this is also proof of Brettanomyces. Brettanomyces is a sugar-eating yeast that we only discovered about 25 years ago, and yet it's the characteristic of traditional Bordeaux was always to have that smell and that aroma. But that's true of traditional Rhone and traditional Italian wines and such, that we're only still discovering some of these compounds that give wines their flavor.
Okay, I hold in my hands information about the last wine we're going to taste today. This is the Cabernet, and it comes from Argentina, Doug. It's known for its red wines, and here's another blended red wine. What grapes are we talking about here with this one?
So this is built upon Malbec, and Malbec is a grape that has been grown in southwest France and in Bordeaux for centuries, probably. However, it never really came into its own until it was transferred down to Argentina about 100, 150 years ago. And in Argentina, at higher elevation, because that's really critical with Malbec, the grape seems to change the way it presents its flavors and aromas. It becomes very generous, very powerful, very boysenberry, very cassis-like. And so Argentina has become very famous with Malbec. Malbec on its own can, for some people, be a little bit boring. And so this is, I think, one of the best expressions of Argentine wine in the market right now, called Ben Marco Expressivo. But I love that Malbec and Cabernet has been blended together. It's been put together by a husband and wife, or I should say ex-husband and ex-wife, who still work together, but who are, I think, arguably considered some of the best viticulturalists and winemakers in Argentina.
So when the winemaker blends a wine like this, Doug, are they looking for grapes that are simpatico with each other? Are they looking for grapes that contrast with each other in some way? What do you see?
It's a great question, Steve, and there isn't a simple answer, because putting different wines together is very vexing. I'm about to head off to Walla Walla to do blending trials myself, and the rule is always 1 + 1 never equals 2. It might equal 3, it might equal -2, but it never equals 2. Everything, when you put them together, they start to interact with each other and alter the aromas and the flavors that you find. So it takes a skilled and, I should say, experienced hand to do a good job of blending grapes together.
You know, the grapes for this particular wine are grown in chalky alluvial soils. What does that do to the grapes? And what's an alluvial soil?
Well, alluvial soils would refer to the fact that there used to be riverbed soils here. A lot of times people will talk about colluvial soils, particularly with this spot, because some of it is washed down from the mountains. You're really fairly close to the Andes. You're in the foothills of the Andes, and that's how you end up with these high elevation sites. The chalky side of it, there's not as much chalk there as they mention on the back label. You know, chalk's one of those magic things that people like to say is in the soil. It lowers, if you will, the pH, makes a higher acid wine, and theoretically then would make a longer lived wine.
You know, I can't help but wonder, how did you decide to go into the wine business yourself? And what did your mom and dad think about that?
Well, I think they gave up on me a long time ago. You know, because I went to school and I went to Kansas State and got a degree in theater, you know. So they were already wondering, what in hell's name is he up to? And like all out-of-work actors, I was working in restaurants. But I guess unlike some other out-of-work actors, I got involved in wine. I started selling wine on the restaurant floor. I had a mentor, a wonderful man named John Scupney, who took me to my first few wine tastings. And here in Kansas City, I had other mentors as well, people who took me to wine tastings, helped me understand the category, and I fell in love with it.
What do we think of this Cabernet that's flying around the table lightning speed here? John Kallenbach gives it a thumbs up.
Really good. It's very, very smooth. It's easy to drink.
Easy to
drink. Doesn't have a bite to it. I would think it would go with just about anything.
Looking at this crowd, it's all been pretty easy to drink here today, John. What else?
Well, I'm glad we saved this one till last, because when I close my eyes tonight, as I go to sleep, I'm going to remember this wine. I won't remember the Sauvignon Blanc, but I will remember this one. It's an excellent taste.
Thank you, Bill.
Mayor, what do you think of this one?
This is delicious. Very easy to drink.
So to become legitimate in your business, do you need to become at least a master of wine or a master sommelier? Or what was your thinking in wanting to become both?
Well, I didn't intend to take both exams, to become involved in both exams. Each exam takes, you know, typical master sommelier paths about 5 to 7 years, and the master of wine path is 7 to 10 years. It was sort of an accident, and I guess it worked out. But no, there are plenty of professionals who do not become either a master sommelier or a master of wine, and typically nobody feels the need to become both. I think you just have to be very insecure being a wine person in Kansas City, thinking, I'm going to get both, you know. I got to get respect.
But you did.
But
you
I
got
did.
It. Well, I'm going to thank Doug Frost for taking time with us here today. And by all means, I want to thank Ted Haberger from Room 39. Let's give them both a big round of applause, folks, for taking some time here today.
Yesterday on the program, we spoke with Kansas City reporters about the way state and regional politics have played out this year. Hear that and more, just go to kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, a glimpse of Kansas City's scandalous history. As the town grew in the 19th century, so did the business of sin. We're talking mobsters, red light districts, and saloons. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs.
I also want to give special thanks to our guests here today who support KCUR. We couldn't do our work without you. Thank you so much. I'm Steve Kraske.
And you are up to date.
Thank you, everybody. Good job, Doug.